Hello, beautiful listeners, and welcome to the Atypical Behavior Analyst, your place and space to hear conversational information about the science of behavior analysis. I am your host, Kelly, and welcome to episode 41. But before we jump into today's chat, let's go over some quick housekeeping. So first off, we're ACE approved, and if you're listening for continuing education units, you can jot down the two key words interspersed during the talk, and then take those over to our website, atypicalba.com, where you can purchase CEUs. And then take a bit to cruise around the site to find additional resources for each episode and more information about our fantastic guests. Next, if you'd like to stay up to date with upcoming talks and live events, you can follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Our live events are a pretty rad time to hang out, learn, and interact directly with our guests, and our social media is a great way to get to know the podcast, so reach out and say hello. You can also rate and provide feedback on your favorite listening platform to help further our dissemination mission. And lastly, stick around after the talk to hear a preview clip from episode 42. And now, today's chat. There's a common adage, you can't understand another person until you've walked a mile in their shoes, and sometimes those shoes can take you into lesser charted territories. In previous episodes, we've discussed applications of behavior analysis in rural communities, but not all rural communities are the same, and we would be remiss to assume so. In this live talk, we meet with Matt Sikoria, owner of Positive Behavioral Outcomes LLC, co-author of Remote Fieldwork Supervision for BCBA Trainees, and host of Behavioral Observations. His work with rural schools in northeastern United States will provide an interesting shift in perspective from our previous rural discussions in the Southwest. He'll discuss the concept of quality of life through a behavior analytic lens, specifically when working in this geographical location. He'll also provide ideas and recommendations for rapport building and having unbiased discussions about quality of life with those from unfamiliar backgrounds and with differing sets of values. So adjust your speakers and tune in to episode 41. Rural Planets, the impact of geographical differences in evaluating quality of life with Matt Sikoria. This is a time to communicate, get your rural community in. You got questions? Ask questions. So welcome to this fantastic Friday. It's Atypical Behavior Analyst. I am your host, Kelly, and I am here with the OG of behavior podcasting, Matt Sikoria. So I'm excited because we've already been kind of waxing nerdy about some audio things. And so that's been kind of a fun conversation to have, but we're also going to talk about working in different communities and different environments. I live in Texas. It's the Southwest. We've got a bunch of urban and our rural is a lot of ranches, unless you go south and then you do get some kind of foresty areas, but then you got the panhandle that's different. And we've had a previous guest on who is up in Oklahoma and discussed, you know, what it's like being there and the schools and communities that they're working with and supporting out there. And so we're going to take a shift to the east and north because, yeah, I've actually never been past like southern New York. Oh, no, I guess Massachusetts is a little bit above. Anyway, obviously, I'm great at geography. It's my forte.
We'll get a whiteboard out. Don't worry.
Jeez, please. I need maps. But yes, we're going to go up north because my perception of especially the Northeast, like, you know, New Hampshire, Vermont, Connecticut, all of those, Delaware, there's these very tiny states. And you can fit a lot of them in Texas, which also means that there's not a lot of people, which is also very foreign to me, because I think we were talking and, you know, the population size of these, you know, of a state is like the population of the metroplex that I live in, which is mind blowing. And I have a hard time processing it. So I'm glad to have you on that we can kind of deconstruct some of these preconceived notions that people may have and have some discussion about different things. I've got a couple of different ideas. Like we're going to talk schools and everything, but then I think I also want to talk about, you know, long-term stuff too. So, you know, making sure that we're including those long-term benefits. So not just looking at the here and now, but, you know, what is it? What are things going to look like in so many years? And because you have been in the field and you've seen a lot of these shifts, I'm also interested to see and hear your perspective on that. So to end my rambling, I would love if you would give kind of a basic intro, tell about yourself, you know, what you've been working on now, and then we'll kind of jump into what you're actually doing.
Sure. So I guess I'll start with my day job, I suppose. So, you know, sometimes I'll meet people, you know, someone at a conference and they're like, do you actually like do things other than podcasting? And then the answer is unequivocally yes. So I've been a behavior analyst for 23 years. Or I've been practicing behavior analysis for 23 years. I've been involved in behavior analysis longer than that as an undergraduate and graduate student. You know, going back to, I would say like 1994, 1995, when I first, you know, took my, you know, first behavior analysis class and started, I got a work study job in a pigeon lab at the University of New Hampshire. And so that's kind of where I embarked on this, long and winding road, if you will. Behavior analysis was very different at that time, as you can imagine. And never in my, you know, kind of wildest dreams would I think that I would be getting 5 emails a day offering jobs, you know, getting job offers, you know, as we all do if you're on the BCBA or BACB email list. So yeah, so it's I've been at this for a little bit. I just as of yesterday, as a matter of fact, I have been board certified for 20 years. So I got my little piece of paper in June of 2002. So, yeah, I fell in love with behavior analysis. It clicked, you know, my story is probably not, aside from, you know, being older and my story is not all that different from a lot of other people in terms of, you know, I took a class, I thought it, you know, it was compelling, you know, and I really was enamored by the inherent logic. Behavior analysis just kind of had this kind of coherence that I didn't find in other areas of psychology. I always wanted to be a psych student, you know, so I'm one of the few people in my friend group from that age that didn't change their major, that wanted to be a psychology major going into college and didn't change their major like 3 or 4 times. I've got a number of friends who did go that path, which is fine, of course. So I really enjoyed, you know, learning about behavior analysis, wanted to pursue it. So I ended up going to graduate school at Auburn University. Got a chance to, bathe in the warm waters of behavioral economics, which was a really, really hot topic at that time. It still is, but it was really coming into its own in the mid to late 90s. A couple of friends of mine from grad school who didn't drop out of the PhD program like I did, have gone on to have very, kind of rock star careers in the world of behavioral economics. It was fun to kind of be a part of that, or at least be in that milieu. And then after graduate school, I left Auburn with my master's degree and worked for 5 years in a residential treatment facility for individuals with incredibly severe problem behavior. So that was super eye-opening, and just worked with individuals who had just staggering levels of self-injury and aggression and property destruction, you name it. It was, we worked with some individuals who were just incredibly, incredibly challenging. That was in Northern Delaware. And then my wife and I kind of wanted to get back to New England where I grew up. So we ended up moving back to New Hampshire in 2004. And I've been here ever since. I live in a little, you know, town that you blink if you drive, you know, and you drive through it. And since 2007, I've been consulting to schools in New Hampshire and Vermont in private practice. And that's been very rewarding. And I've got a chance to work in very, you know, in some of the most affluent and some of the most poor communities in both states. So it's maybe we can get into that if you want to. And then regarding the podcast, I started that in 2016 as kind of like a, I don't know, mid-career crisis or, you know, and so, you know, some people buy, you know, motorcycles or Corvettes or, you know, you know, get divorced and, you know, date someone half their age. I decided to start a podcast, which I think is perhaps, you know, less destructive. so that's kind of, you know, and the podcast is, you know, kind of is what it is. It kind of has taken off again. One of those beyond my wildest dream things. And it's been going strong ever since. We're about to, you know, we're coming up on the 200th episode in the next couple of months. So it's been fun to kind of reach these little milestones like that. And even more fun to create all these connections with people and meet just literally hundreds and hundreds of people that I wouldn't have had the opportunity to meet otherwise. So that's a little bit of a ramble there, but I guess that gives you kind of an idea of where I'm coming from, I suppose.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot there that I want to touch on. But yeah, the connections thing is definitely, you know, a lot of the world freaked out at the pandemic and was like, oh my gosh, we have to do Zooms. But I'm going, but you get to connect with people literally all over the world in a way that is, you know, easy and accurate. And like, I grew up in Germany in the 90s. And so no, there to make a long distance phone call, you had to wait. And then it was like, okay, you've got 3 minutes to talk to grandma, tell her you love her, tell her what's going on and say bye, because we can't afford this. Like the internet didn't exist. So sure. It has been so cool to be able to, you know, meet people from everywhere, and find those connections and have discussions. And that's what makes it fun. So at least for me,
for sure.
One of the things that I had a question about was to kind of get a good understanding of what it looks like up there in regards to how disabilities are kind of presented, displayed. But here in Texas, we still have state-supported living centers, but we also have group homes and some individuals. There are a few communities that are kind of building up now for autistic individuals where they can have like a safe environment to live. What is it like up in the Northeast? Do you guys have facilities, or have you guys broken down to just group homes?
Yeah. So one thing is, I guess I would, one could be forgiven to think that, you know, kind of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont is kind of like a monolith, but they're, you know, a lot of these, you know, smaller New England states are very different. And there's some commonalities, certainly in terms of like geography and things along those lines. But, you know, they're, you know, like New Hampshire is a very, you know, has a kind of a, you know, it's the live free or die state, right? So we're, you know, it's literally, that's our state motto. I think it was General John Stark from a Revolutionary War hero, coined that term. Anyway, so the way New Hampshire operates, you know, and I don't want to get into like, you know, value statements around, you know, political philosophies and things like that. But, you know, New Hampshire is like a purple state, you know, it used to be like a, you know, solid, you know, deep, deep red state, if you will, you know, going back like 30 years or so. But, it's a moderate state that kind of flips back and forth between Republican and Democrat leadership, if you will. You know, right now we have a very popular, very moderate Republican governor. You know, and he was preceded by a moderate, very popular Democrat governor, and it is a small state. You know, speaking of one of the previous governors, I remember going out to dinner with my wife and he was sitting like across the like two tables over, and like that, those sorts of things happen all the time. You know, the guy, you know, he lives about 20 minutes from where I'm sitting right now. So it's not unusual to bump into a lot of these people as they're out and about. You know, so that's one of the nice things about small states. So we all kind of do, I guess all that to say is we all do things a little bit differently. And certainly when you go into other states, such as like, you know, Massachusetts and Connecticut and others, they're, you know, larger populations, larger tax base, more, I guess, predictable political inclinations, if you will, or philosophies or what have you. Each state is a little bit different. But what I, you know, if we're talking about certainly adults with developmental disabilities, including autism and perhaps others, New Hampshire actually was a pioneer in the deinstitutionalization movement, if I'm not mistaken. A lot of you know, people in the Northeast might find this name familiar. There was a big facility called the Laconia State School in Laconia, New Hampshire. And That was a you know, that was the institution where a lot of these individuals would go. And this is before IDEA and before all sorts of other I guess federal interventions and things like that. And so New Hampshire was, I think, one of the first states to deinstitutionalize. And what that looked like has varied over time. And I might be misspeaking slightly. I'll also say that because it's been a while since when I first moved to New Hampshire. The first couple of years I worked in community services, which is to say, I helped others support individuals with developmental disabilities in residential and day placements in community settings, mostly adults. That's when I was still, at the same time, I was still doing some school consultation of for an organization as well. But so we don't have a lot of group homes per se. And again, things might have changed as my contact with this area of services has become less familiar over the years. But at the time, I don't believe there was a ton of group homes. And instead, the treatment model was, I believe it was called the enhanced family care model or adult foster care model. And the idea was that, instead of creating a group home that you staff 24/7, you find a family who is willing to have someone come live with them, and that individual would receive, the family would receive a stipend, if you will, the costs associated with housing the individual, that client would receive supports from a state agency or a state sponsored agency, and they would assist the family in developing like behavioral intervention plans or skill building plans or day treatment services. So like if I have someone come live with me, I also still need to go to work, right? So so there'll be agencies involved in providing what are sometimes just referred to as dayhab services, where staff will come bring the individual to the community and either do some job coaching or teach some vocational skills or even just recreate in the community and things like that. So it was pretty innovative. I have when I lived in Delaware, the organization I worked for at the time ran group homes in the community, and the enhanced family care model seems to have a lot of advantages over the group home arrangement, just because group homes are just incredibly difficult environments to work in. I think if you ask anyone who's been involved in that work, it's very difficult and heroic work. And hats off to those folks who are supporting individuals in those settings, but it's just one of those things where it's if you go into any home, like if I walked out onto my street and walked into a random house, at 7 at night, there's not five people of the same age, or five or six people of the same age living there, right? With staff and all that stuff, So the family care models, obviously it's a much closer approximation to what we might consider a normalized lifestyle, however we might want to define that. And then the group home model is tough just because there's all, I would love to see a group home that is all, fully staffed. In other words, I would say no group home manager ever said, "Hey, you know what? We don't have any openings right now. We don't have any shifts to fill." I don't think any group home manager ever has uttered that statement. And I'd love to be corrected if there's someone who disagrees with me on that. But, that involves all sorts of things like forcing people to work overtime and all these other things. So it's just a tough environment to work in. So anyway, so yeah, there's more of the, which is not to say that group homes don't exist in the Northeast. They certainly do, but I just know it. And at least in my state, again, as to your point earlier about the size of the state, there's 1.3 million people in New Hampshire. There's like, I want to say there's like eight or that maybe, I don't think Vermont has a million people.
there's about 1.4, 1.5 million people in Maine, you know, but there's more people who live in the Boston metro area than live in Vermont, you know, just to put that in perspective, you know, so there may be circumstances in which, you know, group homes may be appropriate based on those characteristics, but, you know, just let you know where my view is at. That's kind of what I see.
Yeah. We'll go down this little rabbit trail for a bit, because I think it's interesting, especially when we're talking, you know, working in schools now is what you do, but you've also seen what it looks like on the adult end. And that's where, you know, having that, I think, understanding of like, cool, we teach a lot of things in school, but oftentimes individuals with disabilities or autism, you know, they've learned to mask. And so I've got all these splinter skills that make it look like I have this foundational skill. And then I get put into a group home or a host home. And all of a sudden it falls apart because, you know, this was overlooked as a child. It's what I see a lot of times with adults is, you know, we didn't have the foresight to go like, what do we actually need to teach in these instances? And in Texas, we've got the gamut of things between the state supported living centers, because state school was changed in 2009 to that, but it was the same concept, just a different name. And we call, instead of having the adult foster care, I've heard it more as like the host home providers, but it's not typically sometimes it's a family that brings them in. And sometimes it's an individual or maybe two individuals who will purchase a house or something and then host individuals with disabilities there. And it's been interesting because you do have kind of this clash in some cases of values and understanding and perception. And so I find it interesting because working in a group home, there's not a lot of praise. There's not a lot of, you know, attaboys and good job for doing these things. And you may not know what your expectations are when it comes to interacting with the people that live there. You know, I think a lot of times it's the impression of, hey, you're going to be helping clean and cook and everything, but they forget that, oh, you might also have to help teach this person or work with this person on their communication if they're struggling, or they use a picture board, or they use an AAC device, or if they need help with their hygiene or things like that. And in a family model, I don't know, I guess my perception is like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, you're part of the family now. So I don't know, there's different dynamics. So that's a fun little discussion.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, it's interesting the different models that people have for supporting and folks with significant disabilities.
And is there a best one? Probably not. It's really, you know, what's best for this individual, and seeing, you know, long-term what their goals are, like what can we accomplish? What's going to make them more successful? And if that's a change in environment, well, this goes into also, what are your resources and opportunities? Cause you can't just pick up and go someplace else if there's no other place to go.
Yeah. You know, I mean the group home model, I suppose one advantage of it would be that, you know, if you're supporting individuals with very severe behavior, that you do have people rotating in and out to work with that individual, whereas in a, you know, enhanced family care setting, that is a challenge. And, you know, I remember, again, back, and this is going back, you know, almost 20 years, but you know, I recall times where, you know, I would be on call and, you know, someone would page me and say, look, we need to find a place for this individual to go because they just, you know, they just punched their family care provider in the face. I'm being serious here. And, you know, and it's, you know, so like that's a scenario where a group home, you know, would be perhaps at least in the short term advantageous while we're trying to figure out, okay, well, what happened and how do we program for that to not happen again? Yada, yada, yada. Oh, did I lose you?
We're back. There we go.
Okay.
It's hot in Texas, and so all of the internet is melting periodically.
I see.
So it's fine, though. No, I agree. And unfortunately, it happens in group homes. But yeah, in some cases, the group home, at least systems-wise, is different, and I think easier to navigate some of those problems. You don't have quite the emotional. I don't know. This is where I need to go interview all these people too, because everyone has a different perspective of it as well. Some people are totally fine, and then other people, it's a shock to the system of what it actually looks like.
Yeah, and I'm not aware, and I'm I should probably, the word ignorance probably better, more apt here. I don't know of anyone doing research in that area in terms of what out, you know, which one of these care models is, you know, generates the most successful outcomes. However, that, you know, you can even, there's probably some research about how do we define outcomes, you know, things along those lines. But, you know, so I would you say which model is best? That's certainly, you know, what might be considered an empirical question, but I don't know if anyone's doing that work. I hope people are. You know, it's just an area I don't really spend a lot of time in these days, so I'm not up to speed on it.
Yeah. All right. So there's my call for someone. There's your dissertation, your thesis, internship. Yeah, go for it, mates. Get us some research, because I've definitely seen lots of comments across the interwebs about, like, hey, does anybody have any info on how to work and how to do this? And it's a lot of, like, you go back to BST and everything, but it's the other side. It's the getting the buy-in and getting that understanding. And then there's also the whole systems level too, and who's dictating what and those values. So, like, talking about, you know, to come back to our original topic of schools and kind of consulting in these areas. Yeah. You know, I wish it could just be as simple as an ABC diagram, but really it's not, because, you know, not only is your behavior getting impacted by your life history and all these other incoming variables, but the system that follows around it and how it shifts and changes. So, like you said, you know, having different governing bodies in place. Well, yeah, when this governing body is in place, the values go a certain way, the rulings go a certain way, bills go a certain way, and then it shifts the other way. And even for, you know, quote unquote, normal neurotypical families and schools, it's tough to adjust to those things. And I think it gets very confusing for our learners, because it's, you know, it's just a lot of changes. So it's something to consider as you're going into all this. So to jump in a little bit on the system side of it, you'd mentioned there's this kind of dividing or a difference between, you know, these very affluent areas versus the more rural side of things. So, like, what does that look like for you when you go?
When I'm consulting? Most of the schools I work in are impoverished communities. And I'm not saying this to, pat myself on the back. I consider it a privilege to, you know, to work in those settings. There's so much need. So I would say, you know, I've also had opportunities to work, like I said earlier, in settings that are, you know, on the other end of the income scale. I guess one of the things I'll say before getting started here is that, you know, we've talked about this on the telephone, I think, before, but, you know, one of the notions that people have, particularly about, like, New England, and if you think of, like, the state of Vermont, for example, everyone, you know, thinks of Vermont as, like, ski areas and the University of Vermont, Lake Champlain and Ben and Jerry's and, you know, all these kind of, like, idyllic pastoral, you know, settings and things like that, where, you know, the world is awesome and nothing bad ever happens and so on and so forth. And the reality, and that was my impression of a state like Vermont as well, because I only knew it as a tourist, essentially. I grew up in Massachusetts. We go up there to, like, ski. I wanted to go to the University of Vermont in the worst way until I found out how much it cost. And, you know, so I was, that I was familiar with the stuff that everyone's familiar with. And then between all those cool areas, there's everything else in between. And what you find a lot when you travel around, off the beaten path, if you will, is that there's a ton of rural poverty and, you know, people living in really rough conditions, a lot of, just, you know, generationally depressed areas, you know, and it's the same thing with New Hampshire, same thing with Maine, you know, and so it's tough because a lot of these, you know, places that have been depressed for a long, long time, they have this mix of disability, addiction, poverty, you know, if you want to talk generational trauma, you know, you could throw that in there as well, I suppose, you know, and that leads to a community that is that presents with many more challenges than other communities do. You know, so these communities experience more, you know, crime. You know, the schools are have more, you know, burdens placed on them because a lot of times these kids come into the schools, you know, with, and the, you know, with bringing the baggage of these challenges in with them. So I think that it's something that I think is, I don't know, I feel it's important for people to know about, you know, it's not just, you know, here in New Hampshire, it's not just, you know, North Conway and Lake Winnipesaukee and all the other kind of places that people like to go recreate. You know, it's more than the White Mountains, you know, in and around the White Mountains, there's a lot of, places that are just really rough. And so, I think what that does, I don't have, these are my anecdotal observations. So I'll just be clear about that. And I wish I had data to support this, and maybe those data exist. But what I would say is that I think what that results in is that you have a higher proportion of students in a student body who have various types of needs, whereas the proportion is lower, I would say, in, you know, kind of middle and upper class or up, you know, middle and upper SES or whatever, you know, kind of economic term du jour that people like to use these days. So I think that the overall level of need is proportionally higher. So you have kids entering kindergarten with a lot more just general behavior problems. You have kids entering kindergarten with, you know, not a lot of exposure to, you know, being read to and all those other things that we know conducive to, you know, academic growth and development and things like that. So you have this kind of mix of not only these kind of behavioral issues, but those lead to academic challenges as well. Not only because of those reasons, but if you have a student, I see this all the time, you have students who are constantly out of class because they're in the resource room or they're in the guidance office or they're in, you know, whatever, they're somewhere other than in class. They don't have, because they're too disruptive to be in class. Well, they're essentially curriculum deprived at that point because they're not accessing what's going on in the classroom. They're not learning. And that compounds over time through the years. And guess what that results in? That results in making schoolwork a lot more aversive because they don't know what's going on. And that increases the value of everything else. So that's, you know, I think that's those are some of the challenges I think that, you know, working in these settings, you know, presents on the regular, as it were.
Holy shnikes. Yeah, I like the reminder that there's all these layers that come with it. And when people don't have access to resources or access to, you know, basic needs, you know, kindergarten, that's most kids go into kindergarten with some basic learn to learn skills. Like they understand schedules and expectations and, you know, I follow instructions from teachers, but they're still learning a lot of other things too. And when you have, like, when you're modeling at home is not that, and it's instead going out, you know, not being present or physical touch isn't comforting, it's terrifying. You know, meals aren't a regular thing, because that's another thing too that there's been discussion about is, you know, having these regular meal times to check in and things like that. And if the kiddo already doesn't have, you know, those kind of skills, now they're going into a chaotic environment where everything is different. And yeah, what am I going to do? I've never been taught the words to say these things. So I react behaviorally and I jump out and yeah. And I think too often we want to judge and blame the child for not doing the thing, or just stick with like, oh, well, the parent wasn't, you know, present or whatever. And really it's like, no, this problem goes back so many more layers. Like, it's not just this little thing. Like, yes, this is a part of it. This might be a part that we can actually work on. But the greater problem is just this lack.
Exactly. These issues have a very long tail to them. You know, very often a lot of kids I work with are being raised by their grandparents. One kid I know, or this actually happened a couple of times now that I think about it, is being raised by his great grandparents or great grandparent. You know, and a lot of times, like, mom and dad are either, you know, in the wind, if you will, or they're in jail, or they're deceased, or the court has taken the kids away and grandparents have stepped up, you know, and so that is incredibly common, at least in my, you know. And I should also say too that my point of view is, you know, if you think of things in like the kind of MTSS or RTI or PBIS triangle, like there's like, you know, tier three, like, you know, a lot of these kids are like at the very tippy top of tier three. They're like, you know, if there's like a tier four, so I also have to keep in mind that my point of view is likely skewed by consulting on these cases all the time. So that's something I kind of have to remind myself periodically, you know. So like, it's helpful, like when you think, oh, the world really, you know, isn't going to hell in a handbasket, even though it seems like it, you know, these five cases I saw today, you know, this particular school. I'm kidding, of course, but you know, these issues have a lengthy history to them. You know, so they're like you said, they're related to, you know, some of the practices or lack thereof at home. You know, those parents very likely, you know, probably also lack those things as well. You know, there's so many times I have consulted on cases where the parents have also had very, you know, challenging histories as students as well. You know, oftentimes, you know, receiving special ed services themselves. You know, I've had many a conversation with parents, you know, it's like, you know, I never really learned to read very well, or I was in the resource room, things like that. Or, many times I've been talking with parents, like, yeah, well, you know, I have severe anxiety, or I have, you know, this or that or the other thing, you know. And so a lot of times there's a, you know, kind of, in addition to whatever economic circumstances these that's going on, a lot of these people tend to have mental health challenges as well, or it's not uncommon for that to happen. And then again, like, as I mentioned earlier, especially with the opioid crisis, that's huge here. It's incredibly, incredibly challenging. There's always that specter of you know, substance abuse as well. So you have this kind of soup of you know, kind of environmental challenges that, and then you put on top of that, you know, sometimes you'll have a, you know, like 15 people living in a 2-bedroom apartment. So, I've seen that. You'll have, you know, kind of people who are living in shelters. There's one family I worked with, had to move into a camper because they were evicted from their home. You know, so, you know, if you're living in a camper with a family of five, I don't care how big the camper is, you know, I mean, I'm willing to bet it's not one of those ones like you see on those like RV shows that, you know, have like, 60 inch plasma TVs and things like that. It's probably not that glamorous. And, what it does is it impacts all those things that we know are healthy for kids. Like, you know, you touched on, like, you know, having meal times, sleep, sleep is huge. I talk to parents a lot about sleep practices,
when I'm interviewing them for, if I'm doing like an assessment for school, I always like to, you know, I always do like as thorough as interview as possible with the parent. And I try to hit some of the major pain points or potential sources of friction with them, you know? And so like, you know, I'll ask, you know, okay, what is mealtime like? What is bedtime like? You know, what is the morning routine like? Or usually what I'll do actually is I'll just say, hey, tell me about a representative afternoon when they get home from school, what happens? And I have them just basically tell me the general routine from arrival from school up through bedtime. And then from, you know, waking up until, you know, getting, going off to school. And usually in them telling me those, you know, what goes on in that timeline, you can kind of ask some questions, because you inevitably cross, you inevitably encounter things like sleeping, eating, self-care routines like bathing, toothbrushing, et cetera, and whatnot. And so those are all the potential sources of conflict. And what you find a lot of times is that, you know, a lot of kids who have, you know, behavioral challenges in school. Yeah. All the other, and which is to say, which is, I guess the point I want to make here is that, or the point I don't want to make is that these things are influences, that one should look at instead of the basic, you know, ABC analysis of what's going on in the class. Those things are still important, obviously. So I don't want to, lead people astray here. But, you know, I would say that not being, you know, having a crappy night's sleep increases the value of some of these off-task behaviors and decreases the value of doing things that are, you know, perhaps, you know, cognitively challenging. You know, I know that's true for me. You know, if I get a bad night's sleep, I'm less productive, or, you know, I approach hard things with, you know, you know, with a little bit more difficulty than I would otherwise. You know, so anyway, that's, I don't know if that answers your question, but that's kind of.
Yeah, no, there's, I think you brought up a lot of really good points of, you know, it's looking at those pain points, those friction points. So one of the things that I kind of caught on to, because part of me wants to go and dive in and be like, well, how do we fix these issues? But before that, when you're called in to like work with a school, so as you go through and you do your interviews and your assessment, your observations and everything, you're starting to see, you know, what the potentially true areas of concern and issues are. But this is where we see like the shift in values when it comes to what parents perceive, what teachers perceive, what you as the consultant is looking for versus like school administration. Because I feel like a lot of times, you know, we get called in to fix something. Hey, he's banging his head against a desk. Come make it better. And it's like, mm-hmm. Okay. So like, are there common themes that you see that you're called in for? And I guess how often do they actually match up with what's truly quote unquote going on, if that makes sense?
Well, I don't know if this answers your question, but sometimes what I have to do is kind of manage the expectations of the people I'm consulting with first, you know. So for example, I was consulting to a high school, and I really had to have the conversation, like, what magic wand do you think I actually have here? And I said it a little bit more, you know, nicely than that. You know, so I think that there are times where you have to kind of set expectations that, you know, and so sometimes people have if they don't have a lot of experience with behavior analysts and behavior analysis, they don't really understand what it does. They think you're another type of counselor, if you will, that if you just meet and talk to this kid, they're going to, oh my gosh, I've been doing it all wrong. I'm going to, you know, straighten up and fly right, you know, and you know, so I can't really get into, you know, I don't want to get into the details. I don't think there's any way to tie it back to this individual, but, or this community or whatever, but just in case there is, I'm just going to err on the side of caution. But it was just one of those things where it's like the presenting problem, and the resources that they had to do, they were willing to apply towards it, were a huge mismatch. You know, like in in another example, there was a, I was called into because, you know, a student was not attending school. And when they were cutting class. And I'm like, well, what are your class cutting procedures? And they're like, you know, then that, you know, it's like, okay, well, let's start there. You know, like, so what happens if, you know, like, do you guys take attendance every class? Where does it go? You know, do those get matched up with the absentee, you know, roster? You know, does someone go try to find kids if they're, you know, if, you know, and it's like, you know, all right, you guys have to like do something here, you know? So so that's kind of like a, I guess, an extreme example where, you know, but most of the time the folks I work with are the staff I work with are earnestly trying to solve a problem. So, truth be told, I spend more time working in elementary school settings than I do in high school settings. It's really difficult to consult at the high school level. You know, to quote Greg Hanley, you know, when the reinforcers are sex, drugs, and rock and roll, it's and you don't have control over any of them. You know, that's a really, really difficult area in which to intervene. But in elementary settings, I'm, you know, typically working with kids who are not on the spectrum, actually, you know. So I'm like one of those behavior analysts who works with individuals with a pretty wide variety of challenges. Sometimes they're not even on an IEP, you know, so they may just be experiencing some difficulties. And so I'm brought in as part of a child support team or something like that. You know, let's get an observation on, maybe there's some, you know, low hanging fruit we can identify that, you know, some simple changes that might be made in classroom settings to help kids. But, you know, usually it's elementary age kids who are disrupted in the classroom setting. So, you know, and I try to, you know, try things, you know, very simple behavioral interventions. You know, so one of the first things I'll try to do is say, okay, is this a classroom management issue? You know, one of the things, if you're not familiar with, public school settings, one of the things that would be interesting, if you sit in a second grade classroom and think about if you count the opportunities that students have to respond, you know, we're familiar with the term active student responding. That's not really a concept that's top of mind in a lot of these settings. So a lot of times kids are sitting for long periods of time and not being asked to respond in any way. And there's this assumption that they're going to sit and absorb this material. I see that as a problem. So I'm usually, you know, what I try to do is get teachers acquainted with some of the choral response literatures, you know. So like, you know, if you're talking to the class, punctuate every sentence with everybody, you know, whereas everybody is the cue to chorally respond. So I'm saying, oh, you know, the capital of New Hampshire is Concord. Everybody, Concord. The whole class goes Concord, you know. So what's going on with, you know, the opportunities to respond? You know, it's funny because I don't really collect ABC data per se. What I do is I just open up a document and just kind of write what's going on, and as non-judgmental. Well, I mean, I'll get to that in a second. But I suppose. But I'll just write what's going on. Every once in a while, I'll put in like, you know, this is boring. Like try to like put myself in like a kid's class, you know, perspective. Like this lesson is super boring. It's funny because one of my colleagues, we were collaborating on this this one student, and she's like, can you send me your notes? I'm like, on this kid? I'm like, yeah, these are just like my raw scribbles. She's like, no, that's fine. Just send it to me. I'm like, are you sure? She's just reading them. She texted me later. She's like, I think I might have said like, you know, this class is, you know, BS, but I think I typed out BS, you know. You know, just having my own kind of middle school responses to, 14-year-old Matt Sicoria would say, you know, but anyway, so, you know, I find that helpful. That's a tip I got from our mutual friend, Merrill Winston, you know, write what's going on, you know, analyze it later. But, you know, so those are some things that, you know, we see frequently, you know, so it could be something like increasing opportunities to respond. You know, if a teacher is willing to do something like play the good behavior game, I really try to, you know, use that because that's a, you know, it's a group contingency. It's going to affect all sorts of kids because a lot of times what happens is that I get brought in to consult and the teacher's like, well, I actually have a good handle on that kid, but that one over there, you know, and I'm like, okay, I put my fingers in my ears and it's like, okay, well, I can't know about Johnny right now because I don't have consent to know about Johnny and, you know, yada, yada, yada. But anyway, I'm kind of rambling here. I don't know if that gets at what you were asking.
Alrighty, cool humans. If you are listening for continuing education credits, here is the first of your two keywords. First word is friction. F-R-I-C-T-I-O-N. It is beneficial to determine the friction points across environments. Friction.
Oh, yeah. Because again, it's, you know, the concerns that we get called in for a lot of times are things like, well, they're being disruptive. And then you go in and you start unpacking a little bit. And it's like, oh, well, the lesson is boring. They're not engaged. They're, you know, the teacher was out of the room for a period of time and they got distracted. Because I'm definitely one of those people, like, I have to be constantly fidgeting in order to sit still. So like, I would doodle and some teachers were totally cool with it. Yeah, if you doodle, so long as you're still taking notes, you're still engaged, you respond when I throw something out there, cool. But then there are those teachers that are like, well, no, you can't do those things. And those are kind of some preconceived notions that, you know, I feel like I'm bashing on teachers for a second, but I apologize. Teachers, you know, we can get stuck in our ways and like, well, I've always taught the classroom like this and I've always done it this way. And it's like, but times change and little humans change and the way that they do things is a little bit different too. So when you observe those kind of things, especially like a boring lesson, you know, yes, adding the active engagement and everything like that is one way to do it. But how do you have that kind of nice conversation to be like, okay, like, I know you think this is a him problem, but really, it's a you problem. So what's kind of your nice way to have that discussion?
Well, you know, I think the first thing I'll do, you know, I mean, you know, you have to do some kind of, you know, quickly find ways to build some sort of rapport with the teacher before that conversation happens, you know, I can, you know, I can send you some links to some shows that I've done about that. But you know, you want to real briefly though, like you want to, when possible, it's not always possible. Sometimes there's something going on and they want you to come right in and see what's going on right away. And the timing is such that, you know, you have to see the math right now because it's going on right now and things like that. But when those things aren't in place and you have the luxury of arranging things in advance, what I try to do is have a meeting with the teacher ahead of time. And it doesn't have to be formal or anything like that. I just, you know, say, hey, you know, my name is Matt. I'm a behavior analyst. I know it's kind of a funny title, but here's what it means. And, you know, I what I usually do, Kelly, is I make fun of myself. You know, I really like, you know, and I will, and that works for me. It may not work for everyone, but I feel like Matt, you know, massive amounts of self-deprecation, will make coming on, you know, I'll say something like, you know, I've never taught the second grade, you know, and I have no idea what it's like to command the attention or attempt to command the attention of, you know, the 23, 8-year olds, you know. So, you know, like I'll say, you know, I'll start sentences like with those, like, you know, elongated frames, if you will. And what I did notice, you know, so, like, you know, so and I'll also say, like, look, I'm going to make some suggestions here, or I'm going to tell you what it looks like from my perspective. And I want you to be, you know, really honest, you know, so, you know, I'll try to like, really like, you know, you don't just come out and say, well, you know, I think you don't ask the kids to do enough. And I think blah, 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 blah. You know, if you come off like that, you know, there are some teachers who are like, give it to me straight. I don't want the, you know, don't sugarcoat it. I need help and I need you to tell me what to do and I'll do it. And those are fun. Those are fun situations. You can just really, you know, kind of jam, if you will. But I, you know, a lot of teachers are stressed out. They've exhausted their bag of tools. I've had countless teachers break down and cry, because they think about these kids 24/7, you know, and they worry about them. And when they get to the point of maybe losing empathy for them, then they're like, you know, I just want this kid out of here, you know? And so there's this kind of like, depending on where they are on that timeline. And honestly, Kelly, I'd also say, I'm also the guy who will say, this kid needs a different placement. You know, I used to think my job was to like, okay, like what's the perfect arrangement to make this kid successful here? You know, and then program around that. If a district has like a separate program for individuals with emotional behavioral challenges that can, that has like, you know, a flexible schedule that has, you know, areas where the kid can melt down and no one's really going to, it's not going to disrupt things because they can kind of calm down on their own and no one's pressuring them because it's time to go to gym, you know, or something like that. You know, I'm usually the guy saying, I think we should consider this kid, you know, like we don't have the resources to program for this kid in the setting, you know? So sometimes, you know, that you have to be that guy as well in my experience.
Yeah. Cause I mean, if you keep trying to quote unquote fix a teacher or put things in place that a teacher is just essentially not responding to, or the child's not responding to them, like, then why are we still here? Like, we're just banging our heads into a wall. And we're just making everybody more irritated, which is just this nice little downward spiral that no one should really have to go through.
For sure.
One of the things that, like you've said, the concept of like resources and everything several times. And that's, you know, another kind of differentiating factor between, you know, affluent or rural, but resources is a broad term. It's not just monetary or financial, but also, you know, access to things, access to activities, access to other classrooms, other placements, things like that. And then you also said what they're willing to actually utilize with those resources. And that's a really hard thing to come in, because, you know, if you go to a school that does have, you know, there's money that comes in, there's a lot of support from the community, and you go in and say, hey, you know, how much energy, how much time, all of these things are you willing to put out there to help fix, you know, this kid or this situation? And sometimes you're met with, oh, like just a little bit. Like, again, where's your magic wand? Like, don't you have pixie dust you just sprinkle on the kid? And it's like, oh, but again, once we start pulling apart some of these things, we start to realize like, yeah, it's not as easy as just, you know, putting him in a different classroom sometimes, because, you know, maybe they aren't sleeping well at home. Maybe there's yelling and fighting that's happening and they're bringing that into it. And so we have kind of this, you know, shift in discussions from when it's something that I can easily access resource wise versus like, we may have to allocate our resources in a different way and it looks a little different. So,
yeah, I mean, I think there's something to be said for social work, you know, in terms of connecting families to resources and things like that. That's an area I'm not really an expert in. But I want to get to this kind of, you know, one, I guess, limitation, I suppose, to, you know, so like, I think it's important to bring in the concept, or at least not the concept, because it's very real, the very real challenge of staffing shortages. So, and also physical plant limitations. So a lot of schools don't have any extra room, and that's regardless of what community they happen to reside in. So there's not, you know, and a lot of places have the funding to hire a ton of people, but I don't know what it's like in Texas, but here in New England, you can't hire a paraprofessional to save your life right now. It's so even these, you know, kind of hard in their luck communities, down in their luck communities, they've got like gazillions of open positions for staff. They can't find anyone to take the jobs. So it's that, you know, and that is a that's an equal opportunity problem, if you will. That's the same problem in the wealthy towns as it is in the poor towns. You know, it may be slightly less of a problem in the wealthier towns because the pay is slightly better, but it's a problem nonetheless, and it affects all these communities. And sometimes those pay scales are a little, those pay differentials are wiped out by the concomitant cost of living differences in those communities. So I just want to put that out there as well. So a lot of times, like, it's not necessarily a funding issue. It's like, okay, we don't have the staff. We don't have the room in this building to, you know, to do this, you know, this, this really wonderful functional communication skills-based treatment thing you've laid out for us, Matt. I don't know where we do it though. You know, we've gotten creative. Like, I know a vice principal who actually does the SBT in his office, you know, with the learner, and that, you know, this is a guy who like really bought into it. And, yay for Mr. His name is Mr. B. But that's very rare. So I don't know. I wanted to put that out there real quick. There's some things that it's not just money, I suppose, you know.
No, that's a very, very valid point. Because yeah, in Texas, it's teacher shortages, it's paraprofessional shortages.
Okay. Same thing.
Yep,
then, yeah.
Yep. And even in like the state-funded facilities, there's massive shortages too. Because, you know, like you said, it's these I can't say that word. In Texas, you know, a commute for me is, you know, a round trip of like 80 miles, maybe at like the shorter end of things. But at one point, I mean, I was commuting 2 hours one way and then 2 hours back. And so it's one of those like, cool, I just put 200 miles on my car today. That was fun. Like, nifty. And now gas is so expensive. And so, yeah, it's again, all of these like little, you know, if this thread over here gets pulled, that's how many things it affects on the other side. It's not this like one-to-one ratio. It's tough because then what do we do?
Yeah. There was another part to your question I don't think I got to, and I don't know if, what was it?
Must've been like, willingness to utilize resources. So even if you have like funding, you know, when you come across administration, or again, like talking about those, the differing in what admin may think this should look like in the classroom and in the school versus like, hey, I'm the actual principal or VP of this school and I know my school a little bit better because I'm here. And so therefore I have my own quote unquote values and quality that I'm expecting and expectations and everything. And you come in and say, okay, well, that's great. But how do we utilize these things? And like coming against buffers of like, well, no, I don't want it to look this certain way, or no, we can't allocate that because it has to go here. Like kind of, I guess, having those, it's almost like negotiation.
Oh, I'll give you an example of that. So this is, you know, this is something I do a lot. And I recommend people consider this as well. But a lot of time we mentioned already that, a lot of these kids come to school with various skill deficits, or they acquire them because they're curriculum deprived, as we discussed earlier. So in addition to looking at the normal stuff that we look at when doing a behavioral assessment, I'll also very often at least inquire about or directly test their fluency with various academic targets, if you will. You know, so, can a kindergarten student, do they know all 26 letters, upper and lowercase? You know, that's like a terminal goal, or at the very least, sometimes it's sooner than that in kindergarten. But obviously that's prerequisite to everything else that comes that stems from that in terms of reading, you know, a little later on, do they know the letter sounds, you know, or are they acquiring their sight words, you know, things like that. I'm not a reading expert. There's probably people who are reading experts who are, you know, listening to this, like, you know, putting their hands over their ears or something like that. But, I'll actually, you know, I think it goes beyond asking the teacher, what, you know, because a lot of times teachers aren't attuned to fluency. They love accuracy, but they don't have a clue about fluency. Just because they're not trained that way. And you can go back and listen to all the Kim Barron's episodes that I've done if you want a deep dive on this. But anyway, so yeah. So what I'll do is sometimes I remember, you know, a case not that long ago where I just downloaded a sheet of math facts. I think it was like mixed multiplication and division, or mixed, you know, addition and subtraction, something like that. And I did timings for an individual. I said, look, I want you to, you know, do this as quickly as you can. Don't worry about mistakes. And we're going to do it for 15 seconds. Right. We did that four times. I got, you know, an outcome measure of, you know, correct, you know, an incorrect per minute. And you can compare that to established norms for that age level. And if you don't have access to that, then you can, you know, do some math facts on your own, and adjust on, you know, from there, if you will. But I think that's something that, so I've actually written in fluency-based goals into behavior plans. Every day we're going to practice, you know, your math facts or number identification or, you know, letter identification or letter sounds, whatever, with the goal of getting towards, you know, this number per minute, correct and incorrect. Because what that does, you know, if I feel like escaping, if I discover that escaping academic tasks is difficult, you know, escaping academic tasks is the, you know, part of the reinforcing complex. And oftentimes these repertoires are multifunctional. So it's not just that, but it's certainly a component. You know, that's some, you know, that will make schoolwork less aversive if they all of a sudden don't have to count on their fingers. They don't need the multiplication chart. You know, if you think of it, you know, think of all the steps, do a long division problem, you know, write, you know, if you write down like, you know, 26, you know, or 432 divided by 26, right? I'm just making that up off the top of my head. And you actually wrote that out and wrote all the steps to it. Imagine doing that, not having command of your basic math facts. Imagine having to consult a multiplication chart with each one of those steps that you have to take with regard to that. And then carry that forward into middle school, right? When you start doing algebra and all those other things, and, you know, it's just, if you don't have those skills in your repertoire, school is going to suck. School might already suck, but it's going to suck worse. So I guess where I'm going with that, there have been times where teachers have been like, I've been told we can't time things, you know, cause this whole idea that fluency is bad, you know, it's kind of like, it's like the academic equivalent of Alfie Cohn's Punished by Reward. It's like someone took something and went off on some erroneous tangent. Right. And so I said, well, you know, do it anyway. You know, like, can you sneak it in? You know, can I, so sometimes it will, like, you know, or I'll go to the principal and say, well, what's up with that? You know, like, I really think this is what's going on. And, you know, so, you know, sometimes you just have to have those conversations.
And, you know, it's a science. And I mean, I wish we were right all the time on the first try, but like, it's trial and error sometimes. So it's like, hey, give me three or four data points. And then if it still isn't changing, cool. Then this wasn't the correct thing. We can go back, like, no harm, no foul in most cases. But I think like the foresight and being able to explain it of like, here's why we're going to do it. It's not just because I want to see how fast he can do these multiplication tables. But again, if he doesn't have these basic skills now, what does it look like in a couple of years? And not just even on the academic side, but like, think of, you know, peer interaction at this point. Oh man, he's got to go back up to the chart again. He has to bring his own chart from elementary school. Like, we're mean. Like, kids can be really mean.
Oh, totally.
And so, yeah, it's those, again, just seeing like, what is the long-term benefit or potential if we don't intervene at this point and try a few things out? You know, how could this, you know, end up, you know, long-term hurting this person and causing further destructive behaviors that, hey, we could have actually prevented had we just done this one thing to start with. So.
Well, yeah, you know, and I know you've been doing a lot of content on the, you know, kind of constructional approaches to, you know, behavioral interventions, and you know, you can think of something like this as a light, where you know, okay, we're building repertoires, and we're, you know, yeah, we're concerned about the disruptive behavior in the classroom and things like that, but you know, if we're building these repertoires that could have the potential to become self-reinforcing, the kid becomes a competent reader and maybe likes it, you know. You know, or maybe they start getting, you know, some making higher scores on their math assessments, and that's reinforcing. Then you've got something that is, you know, kind of generative in nature.
I'm glad that you brought up like the building repertoires. I think that's one of my big concerns, and like when I get called into, again, work with somebody, work on a problem behavior, inevitably it comes, not inevitably, a lot of times it comes out to, we're missing a skill. And sometimes it's, I don't have the skill, ooh, or I've never been allowed to say no to something. What? That's something that we've been coming in contact with a lot recently with some of my clients is, you know, so often people with disabilities, we end up doing this like weird learned helplessness, like, oh, I can't trust you to go do your own thing, or like, I can't, what? And so then they just kind of become very reliant and like, well, I'm just going to say yes to whatever it is. And then we start missing out on these skills. And so, yeah, you know, being able to go in and, you know, hey, we're doing fluency, we're checking out math facts, but also at the same time, you're still, I'm sure, looking and going like, okay, are you still cool with this? Like, is your body language changing? And because, especially looking at kindergartners, those are little humans with very big emotions. And if you're coming out of these years of generational trauma and poverty and things like that, like that's even more compounding. And you sure don't have the verbal repertoire to be like, hello, Mr. Sikoria. I didn't wake up today on, you know, the right side of the bed. Like they're a child. So it might come out as, I don't like this. I'm going to break my pencils and my crayons today. And so, you know, again, being able to take that step back. I like your process too of, you know, you do a lot of interviews and you do a lot of, you know, investigation beforehand. And I think a lot of us forget, you know, we go through grad school and we read the research papers and it seems like it's such a quick process. Like, oh yeah, man, they went in, they did their pre-assessment and then they trained all these kids, da, 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 da. And man, look at their graphs. Look at how successful this was. But the rest of the story is, oh no, there was, you know, so much time put into building rapport and building up, you know, a good understanding, or a more accurate, I think, understanding of what's going on because you have all this information. And so again, it's more into a discussion of like, yeah, here are my expectations. I don't come in with magic pixie dust and it all is magically fixed. Wish right. I could. I mean, there's some behaviors. Yeah, we can do that. And that's usually where our quick wins come in because like, I got this one. We can, you know, and it sounds weird to be like, it's a light switch. Turn it on, turn it off. Look at this.
Yeah. But when you're lucky, those things can happen. Yeah. I don't know. You know, you bring up a good point, Kelly, in that, I think for behavior analysts listening to this, who don't have experience working in schools, and they work in clinics or in-home programs with RBTs and things like that. Schools are just these big, messy entities where your learner comes in contact with all these different, you know, stimuli and individuals and things like that. All the individuals they come in contact with have, you know, different perspectives and learning histories, etc. I actually had the opportunity to during one summer where my schedule was super light, I had the opportunity to cover someone's maternity leave at a clinic that a couple of friends of mine operate. In fact, it's my coffee mug right here. Shout out to Keen Perspectives in White River Junction. Anyway, so I worked at Keen Perspectives for about 6 weeks or so, I think. 6 or 7 weeks. I can't remember how long it was, but it doesn't matter. But anyway, it was a bit of a culture shock in that, like, I just wasn't used to being to saying to the, like, you know, if I'd be saying like something to the RBT, well, I'd like you to do this and I need these materials, and then blah, 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 blah. And the next day it was all there. Like, okay, all the pictures are made, they're all laminated, the data sheets are made, you know, yada, yada, yada. And it's just like, oh my gosh. Like, so I actually told someone to do something and they did it, you know, and I was like, you know, it's just a different setting. It's like, it's, you know, obviously it's a healthcare setting, right? So it's like, you know, the BCBA is the doctor, and and the doctor's word is what happens, et cetera. You know, that's perhaps not the most apt analogy, but it's certainly closer to what I was seeing than my work in schools. Whereas in schools, you have to, like, in many cases, kind of persuade and build a case for and things like that. One other, I guess, interesting thing about working in schools is, especially as a behavior analyst, this never happens to OTs or I don't think happens to OTs and speech therapists and things like that. But, like, everyone has an opinion about why an individual has the repertoire of challenging behavior. And I was invited to a meeting once where it was like this behavioral intervention was built by like a committee of people. And I went to the assistant principal who I said, I don't want to be in a situation like that again. You know, it's yes, it's my job to determine what an appropriate intervention is given all the contextual features of that environment. But it's not a crowdsourced endeavor. Like, you can solicit feedback, you can get great ideas from, you know, I'm not arguing against collaboration. I think collaboration is important, certainly, but in this particular way in which it was done, it was like, hey, let's all get together and put together a behavior plan. It's like, and I'm like, you know, breathing into a paper bag, because like people are throwing all these like terrible ideas, you know, and I'm like, no, we're not going to, you know, and I have to be the asshole and say, no, we're not going to do that. And, you know, or here's why that's not a good idea. Of course, I'd use more diplomatic language than that, but made the process a lot harder. So the settings have these different challenges, and oftentimes, you know, you have to figure out how to be persuasive, because everyone has an opinion about a kid's behavior because they have experience either as a parent or a babysitter or being a child themselves and getting disciplined or what have you. You know, but people don't at the same, people have less familiarity with like, you know, how to fix articulation errors or how to fix postural challenges and things like that. So no one gives like the OT or the speech therapist nearly as much, pushback or whatever than a behavior analyst, or at least that's my incredibly biased opinion.
I think you're onto something here. And I think it'd be fun to explore that a little bit more with some other individuals too that have kind of seen both sides. Cause yeah, coming in, oh, he does it cause he's, you know, angry, or he's just, you know, defiant, or, you know, it's all these other lenses that we put things through. But now I'm trying to think of, okay, so my, you know, he's picking up. No, it was always much more of like, no, he was just mad. He didn't want to do it today with me, but no. Yeah. No, it's definitely not the same pushback, but cause people still want to make us mentalistic in some cases. And so maybe that's why there's more inclination. I don't know.
Yeah. I think right now there's, you know, everything is trauma. So trauma, which I'm not going to be that guy that, you know, argues against, you know, we've you know, we've both done a fair bit of comment on trauma or content on trauma, you know, in both of our podcasts. And so it's a thing, it's real, but at the same time, it's like what I'm seeing in schools, it's the explanation. It's like a skeleton key. It does everything. There's nothing that trauma can't do, you know, like, you know, so everything is, well, you know, and I hate this terminology, but like, well, he's a trauma kid. I hear that a lot. I'm like, well, hey, what the hell does that mean? Okay. And a lot of times these are people who are assuming that, you know, that trauma has occurred, just because the kid, you know, might live in a household that they perceive as chaotic. It's like, do we have any inclination that they've actually experienced a traumatic event, or is this just, you know, kind of like, you know, the people, you know, I don't know. So I think that I'm glad people are recognizing the role of trauma. And I also think there's a challenge to that, and that it becomes the explanation for everything. And then people will say things like, well, this is really a trauma kid, not an ABA kid, you know, which just, you know, again, sends me to the nearest paper bag to breathe in and out of.
Again, what does that mean?
Exactly. Like, exactly. So you're saying contingencies don't matter, you know? Like,
yeah. You know. Yeah. Once you're labeled this, always this. Ooh, yeah. No, that's a huge thing. Get rid of that thought process. Moments change, life changes, variables happen. We respond. But the comment about, you know, just because like this person perceives this issue to be traumatic to them, you know, like living in multi-generational homes, you know, for someone like myself who did not grow up in that, very much did not grow up in that. Like, yeah, that sounds like it would be a really chaotic, tumultuous, potentially traumatic experience, depending on, you know, things that could happen. But for families that's something that they value. And it's like, no, man, I love going home and having like my six cousins over and grandma and grandpa are in the kitchen. And, you know, it's great to me. Holy shnikes. Like, yeah, it's, While we may want to perceive something this way based on our own judgments and experience, like that's the lens that we just cannot do. Like it has to be objective. It has to be, okay, cool. Like, and if we start to see a shift of like, oh yeah, I'm totally enjoying myself when I go home. It's like, but why does your face look like that? You know, but you're crying when you come in, or you're falling asleep in class. You know, when we're able to identify like, hey, here are specific things that I've observed, now maybe we can tie it back and see what those changes are. But to go in and autumn, you know, so many of us, because it's easy. Oh, I've seen something similar before, so let's do, instead of like, okay, this looks similar. Pause, hard stop. Now what else? You know, kind of thing. And what are we going to be, you know, looking out this, because it's individuals, each case is different. And, you know, even if it's the same school that you're being brought into and it's multiple kids, like, you're not going to have the exact same thing for every single one, because they're all unique and come with their own contingencies.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So yeah, trauma as an explanation for everything is really prevalent right now. So
it fascinates me. If the world is run by behavior analysts, it would be slightly better. Cause I think a lot of us have, you know, we don't want to do this 180 shift of like something happens. And so often I see it's like, oh my gosh, how are we going to respond? Let's do everything the exact opposite way. And it's like, well, or we could change little things at a time instead of having this like, freak out. Like, yeah, now everything is through a trauma lens. Now everything needs to be done this way. And it's like, well, no, because that also gets rid of the individuality and the uniqueness and that understanding of it. Instead of just like, okay, well, maybe let's take a look here first and then let's see what happens. And okay, well, that didn't work. So again, trial and error, let's go to the next little step, as opposed to throwing, you know, the kitchen sink at it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know, that seems to be, I guess if you were to think socially, I get a lot more responses when it's like the grandiose change of like, look what we're doing now, as opposed to, oh, well, I just turned this little knob this way. Like we just started, you know, maybe giving some non-contingent reinforcement throughout the day, you know? I didn't have to this huge, like, go see the counselor on a regular basis, because, you know, think about that. When you start putting it through an incorrect lens, like, now the long-term things are, I'm telling this kid there's something wrong with them. Now they're having to get pulled out of class. So, you know, it's very much, it's slow down. That's my thing lately.
I have to mention this. So my wife is a high school English teacher, and she sees a lot of this stuff, and my kids go to the high school that she teaches at. So I hear it from them. You know, right now in that setting, or at least, you know, we're recording this in the summer, but during the school year, like, somehow guidance put out the message that, like, kids can just come there and hang out non-contingently. In a well-intentioned, I suppose, effort to, you know, give breaks and alleviate stress, et cetera. Well, guess what? You know, the predictable response has occurred, you know? So, like, you know, kids who are less inclined to be in class just, you know, said, I'm going to guidance. And, you know, and it's like, yeah. So trying to be trauma, or at least another big thing is social emotional learning. So trying to be attentive to the SEL, needs of a student body, you know, kind of sometimes results in these inadvertently dysfunctional contingencies. Yeah, so it's just, you know,
dysfunctional contingencies.
These things happen all the time.
So, yeah, you think
so kids long story to, you know, so to fill in the blanks, I suppose, a little bit. So kids are hanging out in guidance. They're supposed to be doing work, but no one's monitoring that they're actually doing work. So it becomes like a social time in the guidance department, and you know, not a lot of work's getting done, or not a lot of, you know, not a lot of success is happening, I should say, more broadly speaking, you know. So it's a lot of experiential avoidance, I suppose. It seems, or that's what it sounds like.
Yeah. And then all of a sudden when the next quarter or semester, or however you guys do your grading periods, it's like, when it rolls around, it's like, oh, I'm so shocked that they haven't completed their work. And you just kind of go, really? You're shocked? Okay, cool. Let's talk about why I'm not and what the difference is.
Exactly. Yeah.
So kind of looking at time and everything, I want to give a chance for people to kind of have an understanding of, you know, it is different to go from a clinic setting into a school setting. I mean, I did 1 year as a paraprofessional in a social emotional assistance class, and I was not good. I will strongly say that. I thought I was great at that moment. Looking back now, oh man, I should have done things a whole lot differently. I was a para, I was learning. We've done better now. But it was a big shock, but I know that there is a huge need. Like, as we discussed earlier, there's staffing shortages. I know I've heard from recruiters and friends that I've talked with recruiters about, you know, hey, we're willing to pay this huge travel reimbursement if you'll come move to our state, kind of deal. Like, we'll put you up. And so if someone kind of wants to make that shift, since you've seen, you know, being in the residential side, and then you've dabbled a little bit in the clinic, and now that you've been with schools and your own private practice, if someone is interested and looking at consulting with schools, it's not like you can just go to a company and be like, hello company, I would like to apply for this position. I feel like it's a lot more of you putting yourself out there.
Yeah.
So what are some recommendations that you would have for somebody that either maybe they wanted to join up with somebody else, or, you know, start something on their own? All right, second word coming in hot. Your second keyword is unique. UNIQUE. Each family, learner, and system comes from a unique background. Unique.
Yeah. well, I guess I'll use this time to shamelessly plug something that Polly Gavoni, Anika Costa, and I are working on. So I know they've been on your show previously, but we're putting together some content for, it'll be a series of online courses about consulting in public school settings, and not necessarily from the business perspective, but it'll be like,
you know, how to systematize the process, how to gain rapport, all those kind of like very, you know, how to be persuasive when people are suggesting things that are, you know, kind of counter to what you're doing, or how to develop rapport with the teacher. But we'll also have very, you know, kind of tactical things like, you know, what are key components to classroom management, things like that. And those guys have done tons and tons of work on that. And they actually go around the country doing trainings and stuff. And so the three of us are going to have teamed up. We've been working on this. It's taken a little bit longer than than we all anticipated, as these things typically do. But we hope to have at least the first course out in the next couple of months. So there's my shameless plug. It's the Behavioral Toolbox, and I'm not going to direct anyone to a link or a URL yet. That'll be forthcoming once we're ready for prime time. But in general, if someone wants to get started consulting in schools, what would you do? Well, I mean, I was fortunate in that I was able to kind of, you know, my wife's being a teacher, she had like kind of the healthcare benefits and things like that, kind of taken care of. Right. And so I was free to kind of try to set up my own business, if you will. So if you want to consult independently for a school, unless there's an agency, an existing ABA agency that wants to fund that activity, then you can join up with them. That's great. You know, so there are some ABA agencies that, in addition to their, you know, clinic and home-based work, they have an arm that does school consultation. So if you can find an agency like that, that's great. You don't have to kind of strike it on your own, but oftentimes a lot of people like myself are essentially, I guess, independent providers. You know, and so what I would start doing is looking at your local school, the districts in your community, you know, seeing if they have behavior analysts on their staff. So you can go to their website and see if, you know, look, you know, plug in BCBA into, you know, the search bar, you know, and more and more schools are actually hiring their own BCBAs. And I actually find myself working with those BCBAs quite a bit. You know, there's some districts where they hired a BCBA and we're like, hey, Matt, it's nice to know you. You know, best of luck. but there's a lot of other districts who've hired BCBAs, and the special ed directors, like, we still want you to work with us. In some cases, it would be like, okay, this person's relatively newly certified, so, you know, we want you to team up. Or, you know, things like that. So there's various, I guess, ways. But the person who usually is the, I guess, arbiter of these services is whatever the district special ed director, whoever that happens to be. And usually you can find that information on a school district's website as well. You can find out who they are. You know, you can maybe call them up and say, or email them, say, hey, my name is, Jane Smith, and I'm a BCBA, blah, 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 blah. I provide these services. But, you know, you'd want to get some experience in doing that, though, first. You know, so perhaps another way of going about it is if there are other behavior analysts in your community who are already consulting, maybe there's an opportunity to partner up with them. You know, there have been times where, you know, I've had you know, too much consult work on my hands, and I've had other behavior analysts kind of work with me from time to time. So there could be some arrangements like that could be made as well. So if there's someone in your community that's already providing services to schools and they have their hands full, maybe you could, subcontract through them. I know subcontracting has kind of like this ugly connotation in our field. I'm not talking about the inappropriate use of 1099 personnel. Sometimes there are legitimate uses of these things, as long as you're following all the rules and whatnot. So that would be some advice. And again, I'd really want to make sure that you have some, that you're not promising outcomes that you can't deliver. So you have to have some sense of what you're doing before wading into a classroom and,
trying to do stuff there, you know, you know, so it might be something where like having a mentor, like some sort of like there are people out there. Like I know Anika does a lot of coaching of already certified BCBAs who are working in school settings. So, you know, find someone like Anika to work with. That would be another suggestion as well.
I like the fact you brought up a lot of districts are hiring their own BCBAs, which, you know, when you hear that, you're like, cool. And then you do some more digging and realize that, again, those expectations of what we do is not readily understood by the rest of the world. So you read some of these job descriptions. And yeah, when you come in as the consultant, there can be some animosity because like, well, I'm in this position, but at the same time, their job description is more like just putting out fires. They're crisis management more than they are an analyst. And sure. So when you kind of come across that, you know, what are some suggestions you have on kind of, you know, and not just building rapport and stuff, but like, I don't know, can you help with like building up what the BCBA position really should be? Or is it, you know, do you find yourself more just staying in your separate lanes?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been fortunate to have like really great relationships with the various special ed directors that I've worked with. So you can have those conversations, you know, and so like, yeah. So I think it's just a matter of defining clearly what the roles are, you know. So there's a, you know, behavior analyst I work closely with who's a school district personnel. You know, she had the kind of, I guess the clout to do this and said, look, I'm not going to be the, you know, the person who comes running with the walkie talkie. I mean, happy to help. Certainly. I'm not going to leave anyone in the lurch. But I'm not going to be the primary, you know, kind of crisis team person just because I actually have, you know, I need to be actually working with students when they're not in crisis doing, you know, skills instruction and things like that. You know, and so if you sit down to do like a session of skills-based treatment, your walkie-talkie goes off because someone, you know, someone's refusing to, you know, come in from recess. You know, you're not going to be successful with the learner who's right there in front of you. You know, you don't need to be a BCBA to, you know, implement a, you know, whatever the crisis management protocol happens to be in that moment.
I mean, that's really the point that I know Anika and Polly make a lot is that, no, like we want to not work ourselves out, like we're still available, but eventually we fade ourselves out to where you're the ones in control of the environment. You have the skills, you have the toolbox, and we've also taught you your problem solving skills. So if something quote unquote new pops up, you don't have to come immediately, you know, on the walkie. Like you can problem solve and think, you know, what did we do in the past that was successful? Can we try those things now? So... No, I like that. I dig that a lot. And it's a good reminder too of, you know, who is actually the client and who are you working with at that point.
For sure.
So awesome. Oh man, I have like a page and a half of notes right now and it makes me really excited.
Yes. So the podcast host burden. I know it well.
Dude. So I've just added notebooks too. So my bag just keeps getting progressively heavier because I'm like, I have to carry all of them. It's a small obsession. But thank you so much. This has been an awesome way to start my Friday. Before we wrap up, I wanted to, if you would like, let people know, you mentioned the toolbox coming out and everything. Sure. But like, what else do you have going on and where can people find you on the intro webs if they wanted to reach out?
Best place to find me is behavioralobservations.com. Both, you know, on the website and Facebook at Behavioral Observations, Instagram. I don't have the Gen Z Instagram skill that a lot of my colleagues do, but I try to post periodically. Sometimes they're off topic or off brand posts. Like there might be like a dog or a mountain bike or something like that, you know, but anyway, so yeah, Behavioral Observations on Facebook, you know, Instagram, Twitter, I'm at Behavior Podcast, because Behavioral Observations doesn't fit. But yeah, usually the website. And one of the things I would encourage you to do is if you go to behavioralobservations.com, there'll be like one of those annoying pop-ups that come up. Hop on the email list because what I do is I send out show notes to every episode to my email subscribers. And so if you like Behavioral Observations and you know you hear something on the show You know, it's sometimes it's like, oh, you know, I'll go look that up. And you're in the middle of like your commute or something like that, or you're in, you know, you're running on the treadmill at the gym or something along those lines. So if you get on the email list, you'll get the show notes sent right to your email inbox. Yeah, so that would be a way to kind of keep in touch with what's going on. So, yeah, so that would be the best way to, you know, follow along with what's happening at Behavioral Observations.
Are you going to be presenting anywhere anytime soon? Any conferences coming up?
No, I don't think I have anything on, I can't think of anything right now. So
that's exciting. Cause I feel like May and June is just like back-to-back conferences for some people. And I'm like, why? This is very stressful for people.
Yeah. Yeah. And it, here in New England, we have like, you know, especially where I live, we have like, you know, 5 weeks of nice weather. So it's like, I don't want to spend that time in an airport. So.
Cool. Well, again, thank you. This was awesome.
Yeah, it's a fun conversation for sure.
Yeah. No, and we'll have to discuss more things. I do want to have like a side conversation. I want to call them like ATB After Dark, where we discuss things like pop culture, like the love of Bob's Burgers, because I was watching old episodes the other day and I was like, oh my gosh, there are so many beautiful principles of like micro shaping, differential reinforcement. Like, look at this. They just behaviorally defined this thing. And yeah, the person I was hanging out with was just giving me the side eye of like, why are we friends right now?
That's right. Yeah, this has gone to some area that I didn't expect. Yeah.
No, it's the nerd. It's fun. It's beautiful. But
good stuff.
It is. Yeah. Check out Bob's Burgers, everyone. It's good, wholesome family content, and you'll laugh a lot. And for me, it's like the Groundhog's Day of shows. That's my theory, that they're stuck in a Groundhog Day loop. Anyway, totally off topic. Thank you so much. This was awesome. And yeah, thanks all. I love you all, humans. Be kind to each other, and we'll see you later. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this adventure of the Atypical Behavior Analyst. Check out the website, atypicalba.com, for more episodes, references, and to purchase CEUs. To stay up to date, like and follow us on social media. Just search Atypical Behavior Analyst. If you like the show, please rate and leave us a review. And if you want to support the show but don't need CEUs, you can help by clicking the Buy Us a Coffee link in the show notes. So until next time, listeners, grab your towel, keep exploring, and we'll see you in the fringes.
Oh, hello there, beautiful human. No one's told you lately? You're pretty awesome, and we thank you for sticking around and listening to this preview clip. So, as promised, here's a little clip from our next episode, 42. Enjoy, and we'll see you on the fringes.
But I tell them, I was like, y'all, I really only have one rule, and that is respect. Lead with respect, everything you do. And I was like, we could link every rule back to that. You talking while I'm talking says you don't respect my voice, and I can't allow that because every voice has to be important in here. And I talk about that a lot.